This is X-Formation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today, as per normal, I'm joined by my colleague, Caden Rosenbaum. Caden, today, what are we talking about today?
Hey, how's it going? So, all right, before we go too far into our typical banter, I want a table set. I want to do something different.
Yeah.
So I just want to let
everybody know. I hate this table setting, by the way. This is already, I'm already in disregard of this entire project. No, go ahead.
So everyone should know that we're in vast disagreement over West Wing. Will's very skeptical over its depiction of the government, whereas I just choose to pretend that it could be that way.
Yeah.
But that's good for you. Neither here nor there.
Have to have
all right.
Dreams and hopes.
Right? We're just going to agree to disagree because it's neither here nor there. All right. But there's this episode near the end of the series that I really loved because it made me think about policy in a different way. And it's where the chief of staff, CJ Craig, she's getting job offers left and right. She's basically turning them all down because if you're chief of staff for the president of the United States, I mean, what better job is there really? That was her thinking.
Yeah.
And then this billionaire philanthropist comes in, his name is Frank Hollis, and he goes and he schedules a meeting in the Roosevelt room. And, CJ's assistant comes in and says, "Hey, there's an offer or there's someone here to see you." And she goes, yeah, another headhunter, whatever. And the assistant's like, "Hey, no, it's really Frank Hollis, the billionaire. He's in that office right now."
Yeah.
And,
was there like a history of, since I've never seen this show, right? I only like watched a couple episodes. Did Frank Hollis have like, was he like a reoccurring role or did it just?
I think this is like a one-off thing.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
And she goes in there and he tells CJ that he's not looking for someone to sit on the board. He's starting a foundation. And he says, "You know, I'm looking for a single problem to attack, which might have some kind of substantive impact, some kind of substantive effect." And then he goes on and he explains that he doesn't know what that looks like, or whether it's fighting AIDS, whether it's fighting malaria, clean air, election reform. He doesn't know. And CJ just looks at him and she smiles and she goes, "Highways, that's what you're looking for. Nine times out of 10, it's the infrastructure that makes AIDS projects fail. It's the infrastructure. They just can't get to the people in need." And he goes, "Well, if you think that's what needs fixing, I'll give you $10 billion to do it." And so, you know, well, whether we like West Wing or not, let's stick to this theme, right?
Yeah.
Since Biden's American Jobs Plan is to throw $100 billion toward energy infrastructure, I'll paraphrase, okay?
Yeah.
If you were given $100 billion to fix the world's problems, how would you use it?
Yeah. I mean, so I've been thinking about this, right? I used to think about this a lot as a kid. I don't know. Maybe I'm one of the few kids that thought about this that always would dream what they would do with $1 billion. And we all did, right?
I think we all did. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say one thing, you know, just to add another more fuel to this fire. You know what this reminds me of now that we've talked about it and I've had a little bit of time to think about this? It's like, what's that one trick, man? What's that one trick that's going to fix everything, right?
Yeah.
What's that one button? What's that one thing that's gonna change everything, right? Oh, it's infrastructure, right? Of course. West Wing would say it's infrastructure.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. So, you know, as a kid, I used to think a lot about what I would do with $1 billion or what I would do if I was a billionaire. Very narrow thinking. I wanted a large home.
You weren't trying to fix the world right out of the gate.
No. I wanted a large home and weird exotic cars, right? I have this, you know, I do love, I'm a bit of a car guy despite being also a tech nerd. So, but like
and riding your bike everywhere.
Yeah.
I ride your bike everywhere.
I'm like a car guy. I know a lot. I know way too much about cars.
Yeah.
But this has changed over time, right? I would love to have some of these cars, but I just don't think that they don't seem as worthwhile as they used to. They don't seem as interesting because to me, there's a lot that's going on in this world. And partly the reason even that this conceit to me, it's like, what's that single thing that you would do? I would do a whole bunch of smaller things because I think that could actually, you know, it can move the ball, right? We can talk a lot about, and there's at least three projects and hopefully we'll do another version of this in sometime in the future. But there's really three projects that I have been thinking a lot about recently. Some of this does actually get to malaria, you know, we'll talk about that, but, these are three projects that I would put more money towards that I would, rather see, you know, I'd rather have done right now rather than later. Stuff I would try to speed up in the process, just kind of little things that I think are really, really interesting. And this to me is really this place where innovation and tech really applies to hardscapes and to biology and to hard science. You know, our colleague Eli Dorado really harps on this. And I think that's really, you know, I think that he really, I'm the poor man's Eli Dorados, as I've been saying. But he's been getting me to think really, really critically about, well, wait a second, we've got interesting things going on in this world, and let's try to do some more experiments. Let's try to put money behind some of these little projects and see, I don't know, what they can do, how they can be helpful.
Yeah. Without further ado, I mean, you said you had three. I'm waiting in anticipation here.
Yeah. So the first one, this actually, I've been hearing about this idea for a bit now. So by way of background, I actually did, before I went into economics in undergraduate, I actually thought I was going to be a geologist. My grandfather's a geologist. And so I was really fascinated with geology. And this is about the time that I heard about this project, which is now we generally call the Pleistocene Park. So the Pleistocene Park is the ice age, right? The Pleistocene is the ice age. Is it the ice age? Is the ice age before the Holocene when we started affecting? Yeah, when we started affecting. I think that's how that goes.
I honestly don't know.
This is really bad. Well, because we've got like, you know, this is like the geological time period, right? It's like a very like niche thing that we talk about. The Holocene is when we affected things. And I think the Pleistocene is like less than our effect of the environment because that's really when we're talking about geology. It's if we have an effect on the environment, or at least that's how geology is these ages are broken out. Pleistocene Park really is harkening back to this idea of the last ice age, right? And one of the things that I think is really, really, really interesting about this. So in Siberia, Russian scientists have basically been trying to resurrect these old, what they're called biomes, right? These old biomes complete with lab-grown woolly mammoths. And this is like this really big pie in the sky idea, right? You get the woolly mammoths back into the area, they'll start trampling out on the ground, and they will help create and sustain permafrost. Basically that, you know, these herbivores break up the snow and they expose the ground to weather temperatures, and like all of this creates permafrost. You know, it gets rid of some of the forest, it thins out the forest, and it creates these larger areas where basically you are able to reflect the snow cover in the area, reflects the sunlight. And so it has a local cooling effect, right? And it's really this entire change. So it seems that when you have these big animals, the Russians are trying to do this with woolly mammoths. Of course, it's like, yeah, let's resurrect
it's in Siberia, mammoths. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which I don't think you should do, right? But you can do the same thing with other big animals. Right. Yeah. You can get bison and yak in the area, and they have very similar effects that they trample everything down. They eat, you know, they eat the, they keep back some of the bigger trees. And so then you have this shift of the trees into a steppe, you know, into a snowy steppe area where there's permafrost, and you effectively reflect the energy from the sun, and you have a cooling effect, right?
That's interesting, because you wouldn't think trampling down trees would have a good effect on the climate.
And yet it might, right? And this is actually a really interesting question, is the trade-off between those two things.
Yeah.
The trade-off between the carbon sequestration of the trees, which can also happen, and that's also another area to be considerate of, right? We are genetically engineering trees right now to pull in more CO2 to lock it into the soil, which is one way of doing this. But another way might be these kind of Pleistocene parks, right? These parks where you have these big animals, animals come in and trample everything down, and you create kind of a local cooling effect, as I said, and you have a change and a shift in climate change.
Well, it sounds like we're reversing what Ross Anderson calls our original sin, which is causing the extinction of the mammoths.
I know that is a
isn't that an interesting way to put it?
I do think that actually that's correct, right? I would have loved to have seen some. I mean, woolly mammoth. Woolly mammoths are to me fascinating. But I don't know why, but it took me so long to consider woolly mammoths are just big elephants, right? It's just big elephants with hair. I always thought of it as this other thing, but they're really just big elephants. Yeah. I don't know why in my mind when I was a kid, woolly mammoths were just like this. They were something else.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why. I always thought they were like separate from elephants, that they were different than elephants, but they're really, I mean, they're in the same, you know,
they're just hairy elephants with tusks.
Yeah, exactly. Huge tusks. I don't know why as a kid, I didn't really, because you always see the skulls, right? You never really see, I mean, you'd always see the skulls or the woolly mammoths. And I don't know. It's always, they were always presented in a way that was much different than elephant, as just like an elephant hanging out.
Yeah.
Needless to say, this is, you know, so set aside woolly mammoths in the US, the question is whether or not we could actually create a Pleistocene park. And what I've been wondering in particular, and so this is, again, one of the projects I would like to see at least more research funding, you know, people thinking through this. We're already doing a lot of these rewilding, right? Bison are coming back pretty massively in the West. They are having these exact same effects, right? We're seeing this already happen. So I think that what we're going to end up with is a form of a Pleistocene park, probably in the West. You know, what's his name that owns Ted, whatever, the guy that owns all that property. He's been really supportive of putting more bison on his property. The guy that owns TBS and the Braves and whatever his name is. He's a guy that has a whole bunch of property out in the Mountain West.
Yeah.
Like just thousands and thousands of acres, all contiguous. So, you know, these projects are already happening. This is already happening mm-hmm. in the US, and I'm interested to see what this effect's going to have. If this is actually going to have a, you know, a climate change effect, a positive climate change effect.
Right. So like bison usually migrate from one part of the country to the other, in the Midwest. Right.
Yeah.
And since Mountain they were
West, like, so the steppe area, right. It's like, it's basically where the Midwest comes to and hits the mountains. And so it's like in North and South Dakota and then down through like areas of Montana and then in Colorado, right? It's like where all of that area where there's the plains meets the mountains, that steppe area is what I'm talking about. That,
so then what you're saying is sort of like Pleistocene Park where the woolly mammoths and the yaks and the bison all trample down the grass and they reflect and they do the permafrost thing. A similar effect would happen with bison in the US or should be happening, right?
Yeah, I think that probably is
already underway.
I think it probably is going to happen. This is still a very nascent, from my understanding, this is still a nascent space in research, and it's still mm-hmm. not very well understood. I mean, these are complicated ecosystems, so it's not very well understood how this is going to have an effect, but my expectation is you'll probably see something like that. I mean, part of this also, you know, the other thing I love is part of these rewilding techniques is bringing back the original cow, which is called the auroch. I've always wanted to see one.
What do you like about it?
Well, so the original, the theory is that there's a singular cow, an auroch, like a group of cows that existed from which all other cows and cattle that we use, that we've domesticated, all domesticated mm-hmm. cows have come from. And so there's efforts to basically kind of shift around these breeding programs to recreate an auroch, which I think is kind mm-hmm. of cool, right? I mean, they're in the caves everywhere. So in the caves in Europe, there's pictures
of them.
Yeah, in Spain, there's orcs, right? They're orcs in there, and you see this pretty it constantly pops up in history books, and especially older histories that are, you know, in that kind of stage where it's, you know, some old stories that I assume probably some of the stuff in the Bible is probably referencing orcs, not, you know, mm-hmm. we would interpret it as a cow, but it probably was, you know. Yeah, an ox, exactly, right? So it's an ox, quote unquote an ox, but it's probably I would say probably an orc that is or something close to an orc. So that's what I'm talking about, like the original oxen. Yeah.
What I think is so interesting about this is that we're speaking about bringing back an extinct species. We're talking about bringing it back, and you can't do it without some kind of innovative technology, right? Yes. Like some kind of DNA sequencing and finding the next closest match. Surrogates, all of that.
Exactly. Right. And having a sense of history as well. So it's history that we know where these things came from. We know generally what they should look like. And again, we're probably going to, I mean, that's the other part of the auroch story, which I think is closer than the woolly mammoth. The woolly mammoth, I think, is a little bit more difficult to get. But aurochs are, you know, if they're basically genetically lineage from the original cows, I don't know. That, that project just seems interesting to me to kind of recreate the things that we've lost. So, you know, we got this effort for the Pleistocene Park and what's going on with kind of rewilding and some of these
bringing back some extinct species.
Bringing back some extinct species. The next project that I would do is trying to understand a species that exists already, right? You know, I know that we talked about this in one of the previous episodes about finding aliens and the alien story, but
I tried so hard to get Eli to say they were aliens.
I know,
I tried so hard.
Just, like, you just try to go down that route. I mean, he's very hard no on that one. I don't know, just to, you know, let's just, aliens aside, right?
So why do you bring it up?
So everyone really tries to find aliens in species that exist that are completely outside of the realm that we could potentially talk to. And yet I'm actually much more interested in species and animals that exist currently that we know that we might be able to talk to as well. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for intelligent life out in the, you know, out in space. I think we should actually be looking for it in our oceans, right? And I think actually there's one creature in particular. I'm sure you know.
Was it some kind of surface dwelling squid?
No, squid are Squid are great. I don't eat squid for the exact reason that I do not like. I have a very serious problem with eating squid and very intelligent.
They seem very intelligent. My friend, the octopus really changed my view.
That was a great little show. That really was a great show, right?
I watched it in that downtime after the vaccine when I felt just kind of eh.
Yeah.
I watched that and it made me feel okay. And it was great. And then I went back to work. Nice. No, but all right. So what is it? What is this thing?
So it's sperm whales, right? Cetaceans.
Sperm whales.
Sperm whales. I know, right? Like everyone, eyes glaze over. So let me go into my sperm whale rant, right?
Give us the spiel.
Yeah. So it all started effectively, 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, when I had never read Moby Dick. And so I decided to read Moby Dick, which if you've never read Moby Dick, do it at this age, right? Do it in an age where you're not in high school and you're required to read it. Because if you take it at a slower pace and it's not a required reading, which is what I did, I found it. It's an incredible book, right? It is beautiful. There's a play in the middle of it. So it's like this book that's really trying to figure out and understand what is what like a modern novel should look like. And so it plays with it. There's beautiful, beautiful prose. There's the imagery is amazing. I don't know. I can't say enough of positive things about Moby Dick. But okay, so read Moby Dick, kind of got more and more fascinated with
spoiler alert, it's about a whale.
It's about a whale. A whale that actually existed, interestingly enough. So Moby Dick is probably based on this whale named Mocha Dick. And Mocha is a small little island that's in the near Chile, right? It's in the northern Pacific. And so all the sperm whales that we know that were hunted and largely a lot of the hunting that existed in the 1800s when Moby Dick took place, those were all sperm whales, and they were largely located in this area of the North Pacific. Well, interesting thing about Mocha Dick is he was actually gray colored. He wasn't the albino white that Moby Dick was described as.
Right.
But Mocha Dick had more than 100 confirmed encounters with people, right? This whale was a very specific whale, a very specific sperm whale that everyone knew about. And if the ship, the way that these whaling ships would work is you'd have the main ship, right? You have the big ship. It would basically be where, you did processing effectively, where you would kill and process, well, not kill, but you'd process the carcass.
Wait, you're saying we're not harpooning off of huge ships?
Not harpooning, because that's a bad way of doing things. If you harpoon a ship and then the whale takes you down, that whale is going to take your entire ship down, right? So what you do is you have tiny little ships. Those tiny little ships go out, and they're the ones that are the harpooners, and they then try to harpoon the whale. Well, Mocha Dick had 100-plus confirmed encounters, and he was not killed until actually many, many, many years. If I recall correctly, it was almost a decade or two decades between the first, confirmed encounter and then when he was eventually killed, because he was a smart whale. He really was a smart whale.
What do you mean?
So he figured out how to basically when these big ships sent out little tiny ships, that's when they start trying to kill other whales, right?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, so there's been recent research on this, and we'll put this in the show notes. There was a new paper that was actually done recently. So this came out in, I think it was in the end of May, if I recall correctly. But basically, the Royal Society was looking at some of these old logbooks from these whalers, because they could digitize logbooks and then also figure out where these logs are located within the Northern Pacific, right? Mm-hmm. So you pull all of that data together. And basically, what the authors discovered is within a few years, the strike rates of the whalers' harpoons fell by 58%, right? So what's interesting, so they dropped dramatically. So the fascinating thing about this means that, okay, so this isn't just the absolute amount of harpoons. It's the amount that the strike rate would hit the whales. So there's two things going on here, right? The total absolute number of kills during that time period, the total absolute number of whales that were taken in after this occurred dropped. I mean, that was one big change that happened. So now we could think that naturally, well, sperm whales are dying off. You're killing off a whole bunch of them. The replacement's really, really slow. And so
or you have a bunch of greenhorns.
or you have a bunch of greenhorns, right?
He's exactly. just trying to kill sperm whales.
Exactly, right? So that would be the harpoon rate. But then you can connect with individuals, and you can figure out that those individuals are skilled, right? So then you mm-hmm. can connect them along an individual and show that that individual has, over time, getting less effective. Mm-hmm. So that is, so you could have the greenhorn effect. So basically it's like you start sussing out all these things as soon as you have these, right. these log books, and you kind of connect the general size of the whale with who is killing the whale with mm-hmm. now where they were. Right. And a general estimation of how big these populations looked at the time. You combine all of that data, and it's pretty clear that those harpoon rates should have been much higher. One. And two, that the sperm whales weren't dying off in striking enough numbers that effectively that the rates themselves, just when you basically add them all together, they just don't really make sense.
There's an anomaly, right? To speak in
right. There is an anomaly here. There's something weird that's going on, that these strike rates went down, despite the fact that there probably were, the population sizes were probably actually much, there weren't as many whales taken from the oceans in the 1800s as many people think, right? There mm-hmm. were a lot that were taken, but that's not really the reason why we have whale populations decimated currently, yeah. or, you know, we're only now just redoing that. We can actually talk about the greatest crime in history was, of course, the Soviets killing sperm whales throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
That's a whole other episode.
Hundreds of thousands, right? That is like
entire paper.
I know.
I got to know about this anomaly. I'm on the edge of my seat.
Anomaly, yeah. So basically, the only real thing that you can expect is the only way to really make sense of all these things combined together is that there probably was communication of some sort between sperm whales, right? That they were communicating what was happening, that the harpooners' rate fell because they were learning how to, you know, as soon as these boats were coming out, the smaller boats were coming out, they were figuring out how to evade them, right? So If your most skilled prized harpooner is having less harpoon rates, something's clearly happening. These animals are getting more intelligent. Mm-hmm. And what it suggests fundamentally is, along with all the other things that we know about sperm whales, is that there's some sort of learning going on, which probably suggests that there's some sort of communication going on. So there's a lot else that's connected to this, right? But this story, I think, really encapsulates the fact that sperm whales are very, very intelligent creatures. We have Moby Dick, who basically had more than 100 confirmed encounters, right? You have generally the population, which is doing better than you would expect given the harpooners.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of other things we know about sperm whales as well. And the big thing that we know is that given their size and given how big they are, because there's like this, you know, as you become a bigger animal, you also get a bigger brain in order to deal with all of the size and the mass that you have. Mm-hmm. So there is that normal rate. But then there is something that's clearly different that we see with humans. Humans are in this realm that, you know, our brains are bigger than really our bodies should be and should be, generally speaking, right? Our brains are bigger than our bodies than just about any other species. The only one that comes close is the sperm whale. Sperm whale, by its own mass, the ratio of the brain matter, and there's there's ways to do this, but it's like the ratio of the total amount of connections given the size of the body is basically on par. I mean, if not a little bit more on par with us, which suggests that they're probably, again, another evidence that they're probably is, they probably are, I mean, super intelligent creatures, right?
What are they? Sapient?
Yeah. Sapient. So the idea is that you have sentience, right? You have experience of general emotions, but then you have sapient, which is wisdom, which means that there's abstract thought that's occurring, right? Mm. It's this big delineation, and it's dolphins. I think dolphins probably are sapient. A lot of great apes are really close to the line, right? Mm-hmm. So great apes are super, super close to this line. And we have been able to communicate with great apes, right? We've been able to do sign language, really simple,
right.
Not rudimentary, but we're able to actually have sign language with great apes. There is this group that's working together. So it's called the Cetacean Translation Initiative, which is trying to see and trying to work on communicating with sperm whales, and specifically trying to decode what are called the codas. So it's their songs. And what I love about this project, so this is all a long-winded way of saying that, okay, we've got sperm whales. Let's just for the moment, let's think maybe, okay, so maybe they are intelligent. Let's try to figure out if they are intelligent, right? Let's try to work towards figuring that out. So how would we do that? Well, we could take, which is what this group is doing, is you take, or you have to collect data right? And you take that data and you put it into natural language processing, which is, there's a lot of really fundamental work that's been done in the last couple of years in natural language processing, right? This is, you know, AI. Well,
that's AI, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. So it's big data. It's, you know, neural nets. I mean, there's a lot that you can do if you have training data. So what's happening now is they're working to collect training data on whale, sperm whales, their songs, their codas, as they're called, to see if we can figure out what they're saying, how they're communicating, and then try to communicate with them. There's so much that's going on.
That's fascinating.
It to me is like one of the, I don't know, this entire project, I think that
this is the all-time high thing that if you're a $100 billion billionaire, this is one of the things that you would just wake up every day and say, all right, how do I put more money into this?
What you would do is you would get a big expeditionary force and you would follow a series of sperm whales and you would just try to follow them around and collect as much data as possible. And you would do this over a very, very, very long period and you try to get data from a couple different pods because they probably, more than likely, they probably speak a different dialect, right? This is actually like something that's not understood well with great apes. Great apes actually speak relatively different dialects. So if you actually put great apes that aren't from the same area together in the same cage, they'll fight each other because they can't communicate.
Wow.
Right. And that it's fascinating to me. Yeah. They speak slightly different. Yeah. They're slightly different communicative styles. So the local regions are basically cannot communicate with each other. That actually creates conflict. It's really, really fascinating. Some of this stuff is really fascinating when you start thinking through language and how language kind of shifts dramatically. Yeah. So, okay. So that's number two. That's project number two. Third project.
Number two.
Yeah. That was that. So the third project, the last project, the thing I would probably also do is, and this is a thought that I've had probably now going on a decade, which is, should we just kill all mosquitoes, right? Should we just literally have this massive, should we just kill it, all these
mosquitoes? No, I am torn. I've always been told there's a reason for everything, like every bug, every animal.
Yeah.
But when it comes to mosquitoes, man, I remember those West Nile alerts when I was living in West Texas, and I don't understand what the good is for mosquitoes. They used to just bite me, and I couldn't get away from them. They loved me for some reason.
Yeah. So why not kill them all, right? Why not just kill them all? Well, I've been thinking about this for, I've had this like notion like, well, why don't we do that? It's actually really hard to do that. Until I started really getting into this idea, I was actually kind of surprised. These techniques of just completely massacring what are called, the current technique is called the sterile insect technique, which is the effort to try to get rid of mosquitoes. Those eradication methods have existed since the 1950s.
That's how they try to eradicate rats,
right?
Right now, that's what they're using to eradicate rats right now from like New York and DC. Is they're trying they're using to make these, the rats
I didn't even realize that
infertile,
huh? That's a good application of this, right?
Yeah,
but they've been around for a while. So this idea of trying to eradicate
this is your $100 billion. So mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes, right? Well, mosquitoes themselves, it's hard to eradicate them writ large. So what you could do, which is there's been a series of new projects that are trying to think through, okay, so, and you know, this is a real massive simplification, but it's like, well, instead of trying to kill off all the mosquitoes, how, if we were going to do it, would we vaccinate mosquitoes, right? How would we ensure that all mosquito populations aren't necessarily killed, but all of those populations cannot transmit certain kinds of diseases. And so there's this program, it's called the World Mosquito Program, that's been working on this. And it's working through this method called the Wolbachia method. I think that I'm pronouncing that correctly. But basically, it's a bit of a leap forward when it comes to this project. And what they're doing is, in very simply, is that these by releasing a very small amount of these mosquitoes, they basically procreate, but don't allow mosquitoes that aren't that don't have this bacterium to procreate. Right, that there's like a method that they're able to use that allows all of the all of the next generation kin, if they're males. So all of their children, it doesn't allow them to actually have the dengue virus. It's a method that you basically are inoculating a small group of male mosquitoes, and that group genetically cannot transfer anything else other than this bacterium that does not allow for dengue viruses to be transmitted.
Well, that kind of solves the problem for me. I don't have to figure out why we have mosquitoes in the environment
exactly.
because I don't have to kill them.
You don't have to kill them. You just inoculate them.
You don't get sick from them.
Yeah. So you inoculate them, and there's also this cost. It's very cost prohibitive, as I suggested about the sterilization techniques. They're just super costly. It's actually really, really expensive. And if we're gonna be honest, sterilization's already happened, right? Sterilization happened in the 1950s in Charleston, South Carolina. We use these extensively to kill off bugs. I mean, we used a whole bunch of different methods, but this was one of them. There were sterilization techniques that were used extensively by the CDC to get rid of malaria. And in some areas, they still do these things because they're more cost prohibitive. Like, it's just easier. Or just kill everything, right? You just kill all bugs in an area.
Drive down the street. You spray the whole street. You tell everybody to stay inside.
Yep, exactly. So that's another thing, which is, again, that's pretty cost prohibitive, right? And it actually just is very localized. And so it doesn't really solve the problem in the way that the World Mosquito Program seems to actually solve the problem. So originally, it was in this Indonesian city. But now they're expanding it out, and it's been very effective. Apparently it has reduced the incidence of the disease by some 77% in the city that's incredible. And so the idea is then to spread to more cities, try to get rid of dengue fever, but also to use these techniques. There are some limitations. It doesn't seem like it's going to affect malaria, which is the big, that's a big culprit of death.
Well, that's a bummer.
But I see this as the first step, right? I mean, who knows? The entire point about this is to figure out maybe that there's some quirk, maybe that there's some innovation that can happen. Mm-hmm. They can really take this method and help it be useful in malaria. So,
well, the big thing for me, I mean, you sent me that article about whether economics is science or art, and that it's both. Mm-hmm. And the thing about that is that in science itself, I think it's either you see something that you can't explain, and so you use science to figure it out, or you imagine something and you try to use science to figure out if it could happen.
Exactly, right?
And this is kind of a mix of the two, right? You're sterilizing mosquitoes and you find out you can get rid of dengue fever.
I think the better way to think about it is not
the imaginative part, just what if you could get rid of malaria, right?
Yeah. Just to be clear, I don't think that it's sterilization. It's much more like vaccination, right? Sterilization is a different technique. Yeah.
But like, you imagine that malaria could be solved this way. And then some billionaire philanthropist like Will Reinhart in this hypothetical comes down and says, here's $100 billion. If you think that's the problem,
here's $1 billion
fixing.
Yeah. Here's $500 million. Let's try to figure this out for malaria, right? Let's start throwing money at the malaria problem this way. I mean, a lot of this has been done, and I'm not saying that this is easy to do, but there's other ways. Nets are a very, very big thing. I know that obviously the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has put a lot of money into nets, and those do seem to be effective in some circumstances. But I mean, there's multiple different ways to get at the problem. And this is really what I'm shooting for, is that this program, this Wallachia method, may be this more interesting way of dealing with this problem.
No, and I've really enjoyed this discussion because it's not innovation and technology in the way that we should all have flying cars or we should all have super factories. It's innovation and technology tackling some really specific problems.
Trying to make our world
better. We don't see every day.
Yeah.
And making the world better. Yeah, exactly.
That, I think, is really the best and probably the most important kind of innovation, right? The innovation that is really an application or a culmination of other things that have all been pulled together that make sense. And maybe they're simple, maybe they're easy, but it's a new way of doing things because you're pulling together all these old ideas and analyzing old data, as it may be, and old digitized logbooks of hunting sperm whales to understand that they might have communication methods. But I agree. I think this
is what could we do if we could talk to sperm whales, right?
Tell them it was the Soviets.
We could ask them what's going on in the ocean. We could talk to them about where they shouldn't be going because there's too much garbage in the ocean or something. I mean, there's so many kinds of ways that we could use that. If we brought back extinct species, we could, have another thing in our arsenal of climate change resilience.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if we're just rewilding species we already know, right?
If we could just make mosquitoes as useful as flies or as harmful as flies, then we'd be in a whole nother realm.
Exactly. And to be, put a really fine point on the mosquito problem, I think the estimates are about 1 million people die each year of malaria. I mean, malaria caused by mosquitoes is a very, very serious, serious problem. And there is a lot of value to be had in trying to solve that problem. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful for all three of these projects. I think these are interesting things that probably could happen. And I think probably, hopefully sometime in the near future, I mean, I have a whole list of these things that I would want to do. And so I'm, uh, Yeah, maybe in the maybe
so we're going to do another episode. Is that what you're saying?
Hopefully, yeah. Me ranting about conservation issues, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's all I have. Well,
yeah. I think with that, I think we're good. So, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.